Eddie Condon and his band opening up today's Fresh Air with a 1939 recording of Ball on the Jack. Every Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock, we feature the series Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz. Today she'll be joined by guest pianist John Bunch. Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will be with us at 3:40 to review museum and gallery shows around town. And at 3:30, Dan Lusk will review another publication from the small literary press on Off the Wall. Benjamin Hooks, the executive director of the NAACP, was in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago to accept the 1982 National Fellowship Award from the Fellowship Commission. We'll hear his acceptance speech at 3 o'clock today. Bill Irwin has been described by dance critic Anna Kisselgorf as a postmodern comedian. He's a mime, clown, dancer, and comic. He's a veteran of experimental theater and a graduate of Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Clown College. Tonight he'll give a workshop at the Painted Bride Arts Center, and he'll be with us at about 2:30. If you listen to NPR's Morning Edition, you've probably heard the commentaries of Matthew Lesko, whose specialty is how to make the most of the resources made available by the government. His Morning Edition reports have advised listeners of the thousands of free brochures that are ours for the asking. Lesko's new book is called Getting Yours, The Complete Guide to Government Money. It's a source book for loans, mortgages, job training, grants, unemployment funds, and business financing. Matthew Lesko is the founder of Washington Resources, an information service based in Washington, D.C., which helps business clients utilize federal information resources. His new group, Information USA, provides similar services for the general public. Lesko is also a columnist for Good Housekeeping. He writes on money matters. Welcome to Fresh Air, Matthew Lesko.
Pleasure to be here, Terry. Thank you, sir.
How'd you get into the information biz?
By accident. I had two other businesses that failed. I was looking for something to do. And my background was really before this was computers, designing computerized management information systems. Had a computer business that failed and had to go work for somebody again. And worked for somebody designing management information systems. But then I got involved in mergers and acquisitions. And when I got involved there, after about a year, they wanted me to move somewhere. And what I was doing for their mergers and acquisitions team was sort of like I saw them making decisions on buying companies based on just financial information they get from the accountants. And I said, hey, let me see what I could get just in the marketplace about this company or about the growth potential of this business. And I was seeing that, you know, in a few phone calls, I get anything. You know, like the company I was with was interested in buying Avis. And I remember in about 2-3 phone calls, I found the ex-president of Hertz, who was in Washington. You know, he was running a trade association now. And that fella just sat down with me the entire lunch and told me all about the, you know, the car rental business and the whole thing about the market and who's big and strong and who's not and why. And it was just amazing. I came in my report from this one conversation, just blew everybody away. They were just astounded. And it seemed so easy to me. So I said, yeah, maybe there's a business in this. And my dreams was to maybe be big enough in this business to hire a secretary or an assistant someday. And that was my ultimate goal. And I started with a phone and a desk in my bedroom, and that was it. And waited there for people just to, you know, find me and work for them, find information. And I had a feeling, though, for the first 6 months, the only people who knew I was in business was my wife, you know, because my bedroom, not because my desk was in my bedroom, but because of my poor marketing ability. And then the business just grew. In 3-4 years, we had 40-some people doing this thing. And it just went topsy-turvy beyond my wildest imagination. And I saw that no matter what a client asked us to get, then we started to handle, we handle client business questions on anything. So if a client calls up and they want to know maybe what's the latest technology in water desalinization or what is the market for barbecue utensils in southern New Jersey, we get the answers to questions like that.
Where would you look on the barbecue question?
There's someone in the in the Commerce Department. That's all he does. He's a market analyst for all those barbecue utensils. Call him up, and he had the information, everything we wanted. So we found no matter what our clients would ask, there was someone in the federal government spending a career studying the subject that our clients needed information on. So what we were doing and what we still do is charge our clients like $50, $75 an hour to get information that's free that they've already paid for through their taxes. That's already available in the federal government, but nobody knows it's there.
That's some racket, isn't it?
You bet. Not bad business. So I finally found something. Yeah, I can make a buck at it.
So do you make people who get hired by the government sign in with you and tell you what their area of expertise is, or do you have another technique of finding out who does what?
No, it's sort of I have a philosophy is that you could find an expert on anything in 7 phone calls. I say it takes an average of 7 phone calls to find an expert on anything. But what happens areas people, you know, who are not in the business or not used to it, will get on the phone and they'll make 3 or 4 phone calls. And after that, by then they're not talking to their expert. They're not talking to the person they want. They're not talking to their barbecue utensil expert. They haven't found them yet. So what they do is they give up because they're talking to people who don't care about barbecue utensils and they don't care about what they're studying. So they're not sensitive to their needs. So they have these sort of like relationships that aren't very good. You know, they have 4 or 5 of these. And they say, oh, I don't need this aggravation anymore. And they give up. And they'll call us. And we know it's there. And we know it's just 2 more phone calls, you'll make it. You know, but once you find your expert, you know, then the magic happens. You know, if you get through those couple of phone calls it takes to find your expert, once you find your expert, you're asking that expert to share with you what he's been spending a lifetime studying. You know, if it's barbecue utensils, he spent the last 15 years studying barbecue utensils. And no one seems to really care about it in the government until you ask. So you call up and ask him what he's been spending a lifetime studying. And usually the problem isn't getting the information, Terry. The problem is getting off the phone. He's been spending 17 years studying barbecue utensils. You call up and you have the feeling, finally somebody asked. Finally somebody called him and asked to share that knowledge he's been spending 17 years accumulating. You know, so that's the magic. And it's a national resource, Terry. All these people, you know, are on the federal government. They're your tax dollars, my tax dollars, that are going for this. And they're sitting there and wanting to share that information. People really need it. I mean, the bureaucrat stories that people get, you know, are really the people they're talking to who are not the barbecue utensil experts. So when you're talking to barbecue utensil experts and you want to know about barbecue utensils, the magic happens. You get all you want. But when you're talking to – you want information about barbecue utensils and you're talking to the potato expert, that potato expert doesn't care about barbecue utensils. And so they may be, you know, a little less than kind to you sometimes. So what happens, people call people they don't want to talk to in the government. Then they get upset. You don't know about barbecue utensils. Why are you treating me like this? And they get – and then they finally hit their barbecue utensil expert, and they're so angry, they get on the phone and say, damn it, you have to tell me about barbecue utensils, you know, because I've made 6 phone calls, you know, and nobody's been helping me, and things like this. And then even the person who has all that knowledge, you know, I mean, you sound like the highlight of nobody's day on the phone, and they don't want to help you either. So that's why getting information or help or resources from the government, no matter where it is, I see it as a people business. It's just a numbers game as far as finding the expert. But then it becomes a people business, and that's where it's magic. Because they get the same paycheck, remember, Terry, whether they work for you for free for 2 weeks or hang up on you right after you say hello. They get the exact same paycheck. So when you find your expert, you have to be, you know, realize, you know, how, and you know, to start using your personality to get that person to want to work with you. You know, and that's why how you say hello is so important. The first words out of your mouth. Because then, I mean, if you say, you know, the first words they hear on the other side of the phone, well, give me this information, you know, you, again, don't sound like the highlight of the day. But if you can, in the first words out of your, that come out of your mouth, sound like you're going to be a pleasant experience and get them to settle back in their chair and get comfortable with you on the phone, that's when the magic is going to happen. You have to be open, too. I got a list of 11 rules, really. Maybe that's what I should do on my Morning Edition program, is 11 rules for getting people information over the phone. Yeah, that's what it's all about, just treating people nicely.
What are some of the rules?
Well, again, it's being open. A lot of people call up, particularly if you're, you know, in our business, we get information on competitors, and we call up, and a lot of people will call up, and they're afraid to say why they're getting it or anything, and they're very clandestine and stuff like this, and then the people start saying, well, who are you? Who are you with? You know, why are you seeing this information? And they'll say, oh, no need to know who we are, you know, things like this. But that's why we have a saying that if they have to ask you who you are or why you need the information, you're not doing your job. You have to eliminate any air of mystery right off the bat so they feel free in giving you this information. You know, return favors, talk about other things, you know, get them to know you as a person, not just a business person. You know, I'm calling for business information. I'm Mr. Business and I need business information today. And, you know, people want to relate on a deeper level than that, and because it's harder to flunk somebody you know. So get them to know you as an individual. Talk about the, you know, the Sixers winning last night finally or whatever, you know, to let them know you more. Because I remember when I taught school, you know, if I had 2 people flunking, and I taught college for about 3 years, if I had 2 people flunking in the class, you know, the person who would come after class, and undoubtedly one would be a little smarter and start coming after class and my office hours and showing me pictures of his dog and his mother and things like this. And I'd say, oh, I had a dog like that, or I had a mother like that. That kid got smarter as the semester went on. I don't know. The more I got to know that person as a human being, he got smarter. And at the end of the semester, he was a lot easier to pass, give the benefit of the doubt, than that son of a gun who, you know, I didn't know from, you know, a hole in the wall. He was so easy to flunk that person I didn't know. Getting information is the same way.
You said it takes about 7 phone calls to reach your destination in information. But I think most of us have had experiences of having to make 8 or 9 just to find out what form we need.
That's
for something.
Right.
A really simple thing. And you get put from one extension to the other.
Oh,
and,
it's
you know,
an average
called,
of 7.
And it's very frustrating. Right. How do you know where to start? Say you're looking for something that's pretty obscure and you're convinced that somewhere in Washington there's an expert
right.
who's on the government
Well, you know
payroll.
What to do is get people – I mean, if you're not really sure, what I do, the first thing I say, who has to know this stuff? Whose business is it to – you know, they should know this stuff. You know, you want to know how much it costs to build a nuclear power plant? Well, someone in energy has to know that stuff. But if you're not even that clever and, you know, can relate things like that, what I would do, there's a whole bunch of organizations in Washington that will do that research for free. You could call the local federal information center and say, hey, I want to know the latest – you know, the supply and demand of Maine potatoes. Who in the government could I talk to? They'll find you someone. You could call the National Referral Center, which is part of the Library of Congress. They'll find you a free expert. An organization provides free information on any topic anywhere in the world, and their services for free. You call your local congressman's district office. That's what they're there for. They have people there to work on problems, how the government can help you. So these are people that actually do what we charge $75 an hour for. They'll do it for free.
Do you think that these people resent you since you're making your living and paying your staff a 40 based on what they're supposed to do for free? You're also making more work for them.
Right. Well, I don't know. I mean, those that do resent it, I think are I think it's small-minded, you know, I mean, but I'm very biased about it, so I'm not the person to ask. Some people do resent it because they're making too much work. Well, I mean, I feel the government isn't just for special people. The government is our government, and it's for everybody. And if somebody has a right to that information or services or money or whatever it is, we all have a right to it, and that's what it should be. And if we're either cut off the program so nobody has it or it's for everybody, we shouldn't be – we're not a country of elitists. I mean, we are, but we, you know, in theory, we shouldn't. And I don't want to contribute to that.
When you have a personal need for information, do you find that you know how to do it or do you start stumbling when it's personal?
It surprises me. Like I had a back problem for years and years, you know, and I thought it was from my Navy. I spent 3 years, 2 months, 9 days in the Navy, and I had a sore back for 10 years after that. I thought, oh, it was probably just from the Navy. And I'm sitting there. This was there the first 6 months of my business when nobody was calling me. And I thought, well, let's go take your own medicine. I called NIH, National Institutes of Health, and I found a person there who really runs a budget of literally hundreds of millions of dollars every year trying to figure out the causes to back problems. And I've been going to my doctor for years, you know, and he was giving me stuff like, well, everybody has them. You know, I know, but, you know, that really doesn't help me. So I called NIH, and I found that one person really in the world spending millions of dollars of taxpayers' money every year trying to figure out the problems to back problems. And he was telling me how, like, 99% of, you know, the research showed that 99% of the back problems is really because of the way we spend our life. We sit down most of the time, tension, you know, tightens the muscles in the back. Those vertebrae start going on top of each other and everything. And the results is really not exercising those muscles. So keeping those muscles flexible really would eliminate back problems, you know, for 99% of the people. And he recommended some books and things like that. And really within 2-3 weeks, my back problem went away. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I've been going to my doctor all this time, you know, and just thought it was something I had to live with. And right there in my backyard was the best available expertise in the world on that subject for the price of a phone call.
Could we all call him too?
You bet.
What's his name?
Actually, he just retired.
Oh, too bad.
I got it at home, though, if you really want to tell me. His office.
All right. I'll call you.
You have back problems?
Well, a little one, yeah. We'll see what he can do. You've been doing your feature on NPR for a number of months.
Mm-hmm.
What do you get the most feedback about? You always give out information about how you can get a brochure for free from the government or
Actually, the brochure is my brochure. See, I make up a brochure because I have a problem when, see, most of the stuff I talk about in Washington is where to go for this, where to go for that. And what I don't like to do, I don't think it's really helpful to sit there on the radio and say, well, you want this information, call the Department of Defense. You know, and you look on the phone book, there's 82,000 numbers for the Department of Defense. Again, it's going to take you 9 phone calls just to say where. So what I devise my program in the morning edition is I give out a free handout. My free handout, not the government's, that lists all the sources of where to go on that topic. Like when we did one at home, I had like almost 150 sources of information of either expertise or free pamphlets or whatever on that subject. The biggest one we had was government red tag specials. I must have had over 5,000 inquiries on government red tag specials. And people still want that. They have to write NPR up in Washington and red tag specials. And that showed over 22 actually free commodities you could get from the federal government. Like, you know, you could get free shrubbery from the federal government. You could get things like free Christmas trees from the federal government. You could get free fish, free horses. All these things are available for free. Or even surplus property from the federal government that's available at 10 or 20% of original value. You know, and if you're a nonprofit organization like NPR, you could get free surplus property from the government. You could furnish all your NPR studios with government property surplus for free. They give it to nonprofits free. Nonprofit organizations also get land from the government for free. I was just read about another case of a nonprofit organization in California got an entire Air Force base for $1 from the federal government. Anybody, folks like you and I, could take advantage of houses for $1 under the Urban Homesteading Act. Like a woman up in Cleveland I talked to was paying rent at $300 a month for herself and her two children, found one of these houses for $1 under her Urban Homesteading Act, and what she also got was a rehabilitation loan from the government for $10,000 because the house was in great shape. Fixed it up, now has a great house, and only pays $150 a month and owns her house versus $300 a month as a renter. All these kind of programs, and most of those actually are in my book too, and that's why I think the book is doing so well. I guess people, you know, in addition to, you know, goods, you know, in addition to services, you know, the government has so much money and goods available, too, that people don't know about.
You know, in all those months of hearing you on Morning Edition, I think I misunderstood what you were giving
really?
Away.
Really?
I thought, like, I could write and get a free brochure from an agency about something.
I see.
I have this basic distrust of free brochures. I figured, like, the free brochure that tells you how to save money is, here's a money-saving tip. Turn off your heat in the winter.
Right.
You know, so, something well, that's, like, really obvious
like
and
that.
You can't
yeah,
really take advantage
right.
of.
A lot of them are like that, but I'm trying to connect people to our sources. In other words, I really think people have to help themselves, you know, and I want to give them the tools, the hammer, the saws, or whatever, to build their house. I don't want to build it for them. I think people get more things out of it, more out of it that way.
Well, your new book, Getting Yours, is on getting money and loans and information about mortgages, things like that. How do you think the current administration has affected the availability of the kinds of monies that you
Well, you know, it's amazing. We read the headlines, no more money in the federal government, program cutbacks, things like that. That's true. Some programs have been cut back, and the requirements have been changed on others, and they dropped a few. But there's over 800 programs, Terry, in the federal government, and what the headlines talk about are just one or two programs, 800 programs. In 1982, the federal government is going to give out $678 billion worth of loans, grants, loan guarantees, and direct payments. That's an average of $4,500 that's going to be given out this year alone to every U.S. adult. That's how much money is going to be given out. You know, and the amount of this has actually increased after Reagan budget cuts in 1982. This money has increased 6.6% over 1981. So it's really a misnomer when we talk about budget cuts. What has been cut is the growth of this money. The rate of growth in this money has been cut, not the absolute dollar value. So there's more money available in these programs than ever before. And another thing people don't realize, there's more than one program for anything. Like people trying to get college money, you know, go to college. We read about the cuts in college money. Well, there's more money available for college students this year than ever before. They've changed the requirements of some programs, but there's 80 different programs that people could take advantage of. I mean, there's 30, you know, programs that offer traineeships and scholarships scholarships in everything from drug abuse to air pollution. Graduate students who are worried about their program money going away next year should look other places besides the Department of Education for their money. I've seen graduate students get $10,000 from the Department of Labor to do their thesis because it was labor productivity. Or money from the Department of Energy, $15,000 to do their thesis because it was a coal-related topic. The Smithsonian Institution gives graduate students $14,000 a year to study things like history of music in the White House or Art Deco in New York City during the 1940s. Even if you don't want to go to school, you want to play your jazz saxophone. I was talking to a jazz saxophone player in New England who got $10,000 to study his jazz saxophone for a year and write music. You know, there's 12 programs aimed at science education alone. You want to do a film. Some recent Academy Award award winners have been originally financed with money from the federal government. Best Boy, that was produced right here in Philadelphia. That was originally started with money from the federal government. Harlan County, USA was another Academy Award winner that's originally financed money from the feds. But nobody knows there's money there. The problem is we have $678 billion that has to be given out in 1982, and there's not a nickel spent to let you and I know that this money is there. So the whole country runs around thinking either that money is only for real poor people or it's for people who take congressmen and senators to lunch. That's what I thought before I came to Washington. I grew up in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and to me, you know, getting money from the federal government was beyond my imagination. But no, it's for folks who know it's there. To do this book, I interviewed over 300 people, you know, folks like you and I that got money to change their lives, you know, like the saxophone player or the lady who got the house for a dollar in Cleveland. There's a boys club in Jersey City I talked to who got $250,000 from the Department of Interior to take an abandoned coal dump and make it into a playground and gymnasium for themselves. You know, you could get $25,000 from the Department of Interior to become a prospector and mine for gold or silver or whatever you want. I mean, there's 800 programs. Individuals alone are eligible for 500 of these programs.
What are your tips for applying, for locating the place,
right,
and then applying?
The problem is you have to know where the program is. And again, nobody's doing that. If you don't have my book, I mean, my book is really an accessible place that collects them all. If you don't have that, think of the agencies, you know, that may be interested. And just ask for a collection of all their programs. You need a shopping list to ask for because no one in the government is going to ask you if they're like you're interested in business. Well, you go to the Small Business Administration. True that they're going to lend out, you know, give over 20,000 businesses loans this year to start businesses. 20,000 just this year alone. But there's other places you can get money to start a business. Department of Commerce, I was reading the paper today in the Wall Street Journal, how a fellow found a special program in the Department of Commerce. He got $75,000. His business was going out of business because of imports. He found a special program that helps businesses like that in the Department of Commerce. The Agriculture Department will help your business. I've seen them start winery businesses and catfish farming businesses. A friend of mine in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, had a little dairy farm, couldn't get rid of excess cream. He got $100,000 from the Department of Agriculture to start an ice cream store to get rid of his excess cream. NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, gives out money to people get in the fishing business. They have separate loans, startup money, other loans to buy boats and other money if your boat wrecks and you can get money from that. So you have to look at other places than the obvious, and that's the problem. People don't, you know where to look, and you need a big shopping list somehow to go for. And you could apply for more than one program. You know, just don't apply for one program like housing. There's 45 programs people could take advantage of to either buy a house or fix up their old house or even their condominium. The federal government is going to finance over 600,000 homes in 1982. We're only going to build 1 million homes. There's separate money set aside if you want to buy or build a home in an old area of town. Other funds are set aside if you want to buy or build a home in a new area of town or in an outlying area. Or if you're a special credit risk, maybe you went bankrupt last year, they have special funds set aside just for that. Or if you want to buy or build an experimental home, they have other money for that. You know, and if you get confused about the application, Terry, you know, a lot of people say, well, I don't want to go through that paperwork and things like that. There's other tips you could take advantage of. Like, you have the right to see a copy of a successful application. So when you're filling out that application and you're confused about it, go back to the program officer and say, hey, I'd like to see a copy of an application of somebody who got the money last year. You know, and it's sort of like getting the test ahead of time. But, you know, you could use that to see exactly what they want, because what you have to do is give them what they want.
Well, we're running out of time, but it's curious to me that you're so optimistic about all these funds that are available where everybody else feels that the money's dried up. And some of the examples that you use, the saxophonist and the, was there a dancer in there or something? Isn't that mostly National Endowment for the Arts type money? And hasn't that, in fact, really shrunk considerably?
Well, the Endowment of the Arts did shrink from last year. Their budget has been cut. But people, I'm talking to program officers in that facility, are worried that they're not going to have enough applications because everyone thinks there's no more money there. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a problem in the federal government. You know, that now everybody thinks the budget cuts aren't there, so nobody's going to apply for the money. You know, the same way college students, you hear about the college money. Well, I have no more money to go to college. No, there's 80 programs in the federal government. People go to college. You know, there's more money than ever before. Same way, and they're still passing legislation. I mean, you read in the paper, just this last month alone, three new programs went through. They just gave another $1.2 billion to the college students. That's for 1982, not 83. They just passed another housing subsidy program where they're going to finance another 100,000 homes, you know, with government money. So, it's still going on. And if people think it's not there, you know, it's silly to think that because it's there and it's their money. You know, we all pay for this through our taxes. I mean, there's ridiculous programs where people get money to build tennis courts and golf courses in their backyard, or I even seen people get money to build a solar heated outhouse. You know, and they think that's another thing. People think the Department of Energy isn't there anymore. No, it's there. And even when they if they do get rid of it, it'll still be there, but in different agencies. It's just, you know, mirrors they're using so much in Washington, and I barely understand it by being there. Also, there's program off-budget money. The budget is one thing, but there's another bunch of money they give that's off-budget.
Well, okay. Thanks for telling us about some of these resources. Matthew Lesko has been my guest. You may also know him as a contributor to Morning Edition, where he talks about available resources in Washington, D.C. and the federal government. His new book is called Getting Yours, The Complete Guide to Government Money, and it's a source book for available government monies, including mortgages, loans, grants, unemployment funds, job training, business financing. This book, Getting Yours, is published by Penguin Books. And Matthew Lesko is also the founder of Washington Researches, which is an information research system that he's developed in Washington, D.C. It's 2:29, and this is Fresh Air on 91 FM. In just a couple of minutes, I'll be with Bill Irwin, who is, he's a veteran of the avant-garde theater, but also a graduate of Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Clown College, so there's a lot that goes into his performances now. He'll be at The Painted Bride this evening. This is Ray Charles. Well, that was The Glory of Love, and we heard from Alberta Hunter, and Ray Charles opened up that set. It's 25 minutes to 3, and this is Fresh Air on 91 FM. 4 o'clock on this week's edition of Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz, our guest will be pianist John Bunch. With me now is Bill Irwin, who New York Times dance critic Anna Kisselgorf has described as an extremely funny fellow. She wrote, "He's part clown, part mime, part vaudevillian, part eccentric hoofer, part silent film comic, part avant-garde dancer. Mr. Irwin is what one calls a postmodern comic." Irwin is trained in theater and dance, and he's worked with Herbert Blau at the Theater Arts Department of Oberlin College, where they collaborated on experimental, politically committed theater. When Bill Irwin left this avant-garde group, it was to join Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Clown College. Irwin is well known in San Francisco and has started to become known in New York. He's now performing at the American Place Theater. It's his latest piece called The Regard of Flight. You may have also seen him in the film Popeye. Well, this month's edition of Dance Magazine has an article about him by Janice Ross. I'd like to just quote the last paragraph of that for you. She writes, "Irwin's life in the theater reflects a mix of ritual, tradition, and outlandishness. In the final moments of The Regard of Flight, Irwin rushes about the stage determined to discard all the gimmicks of the bourgeois theater in his quest for a theater of purity, one free from artifice and pretensions. On his last time across the stage, he pauses at his battered trunk and lovingly takes out a favorite hat, cane, and plate. 'I'll just take a few of these things,' he says apologetically. 'You never know when you'll need a good hat trick.' It is with precisely these oldest tools of a variety performance profession that Irwin has fashioned one of the freshest performance forms in today's theater." Unquote. Well, Bill Irwin will be in Philadelphia tonight for a performance and lecture demonstration. This will be called Physical Comedy and Clowning. It's part of the Bread Fest at the Painted Bride Art Center. It will be at 8:30 this evening, and the Painted Bride is at 146 North Bread Street. And again, that's B-R-E-A-D, not Broad Street, but Bread Street, which is right between 2nd and 3rd Streets in Old City. Bill Irwin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, Terry.
I've been reading about you, but I haven't had the pleasure yet of seeing your work. So if I may, I'd like to ask you to describe one of your performances.
I'll do my very best. I usually try to leave it up to somebody like Anna Kiselgoff, who does it for a living. The work that I have been drawn to do is hard to describe, only in that I'm such a dilettante in my training and my affection for different kinds of theatrical forms that I've tried to weave a lot of different things together. So the piece we're doing right now up in New York, the American Place Theater, is The Regard of Flight. It's a three-person piece. I work with three colleagues, collaborators. And what it is essentially is a clown piece or a vaudeville rumination on sort of a dream landscape, rumination on the avant-garde scene or the avant-garde theater. All the three of us in the piece have straddled over our lives that sort of strange line between the avant-garde experimental work, which most of us began to be drawn to in the 60s and 70s, and the older forms, which I feel I especially have somehow gravitated to or been called to almost, if I can use a semi-religious phrase. The American traditions of clowning that come to us from the stage work, but especially is best captured, I think, in the 1920s, the silent comedies, a sort of amazing phenomenon that as you get more and more historical perspective on it, is one of our great American cultural heritages. The films that were made in that era, at that time, in that primitive state of filmmaking, are sort of unlike anything that has ever been made since, and which, as an American, I feel very proud to have some tie to, sort of like jazz music. Jazz music and those films seem to me some of our greatest cultural touchstones. So if you want a description of what I do, I am a clown, though I began as an actor, and that sort of informs the way I approach the craft of clowning. And to a certain extent, an eccentric hoofer, and I'm looking for a sort of tapestry of American images. In this instance, in the regard of flight, we're using those things to talk about, to kid and to spoof the avant-garde theater.
So would you describe The Regard of Flight a little bit?
The Regard of Flight is a dream piece in many ways. It's begins with the main character asleep in bed. His bed is forever finding itself onto a stage, and so that he's forever waking up, finding himself in front of an audience, the sort of basic actor's nightmare that those of us who make our bread and butter in the theater continue to have almost to a person. We can all point to that dream. The elements in this dream are sort of that timekeeper, stage manager, stern presence kind of person who makes things go, calls the warnings and the curtain cues, and for whom one is never quite ready. The other figure in the piece, three of us in the piece, the other figure begins in the audience and insinuates himself onto the stage. He begins as a kind of critic, journalist, questioner in the audience. In the course of the sort of nightmare transmutation, he becomes an antagonist in the piece. So it really becomes, at a certain point, like the great comics learned in the silent films, that the thing to do when you get to a certain point dramatically is cut to the chase. So the piece really becomes a certain sort of physical and, I would even hope, sort of metaphysical chase of points of view within the theater.
What was it about the avant-garde theater that drove you to Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Clown College?
And vice versa, maybe, in a certain way. I studied as a sort of straightforward traditional actor in the late 60s, logged a lot of scene study hours at UCLA, and did my apprenticeship in a certain way there, and I don't regret that at all, but I was always restless as a sort of, in doing my Arthur Miller scenes, there was some part of me that wasn't quite tapped, I didn't feel. And of course, it was a period of great political and social turmoil, and all of us felt like we were maybe spinning our wheels and doing something maybe even vaguely unethical by signing up for the college musical when the world was in such great upheaval. So I began to find myself working in political, guerrilla kinds of theater, always searching for, there was something about the straightforward, didactic, polemical theater which didn't satisfy me either. I was always searching for something else, as most of us were in the theater. I began then to work with Herbert Blau, who was first, what was his title? He had some strange title. He was the head of the theater school at California Institute of the Art. He was also provost of the institute. At the end of a year, he left California Institute and went to Oberlin College and invited a few of us to go with him. It was at that point that sort of experimental ensemble of theater people formed there in Oberlin under Herb Blau's direction. And that period is a very interesting period to me, sort of in many ways forms the foundation for a lot of my thinking about theater. I guess it was at that point, too, when I finally realized I'm not cut out to do anything else in the world. I'm, for better or worse, I'm a theater worker. I'm an actor and a writer and possibly other things, too, but it's the theater where I'll make my work, do my work in the world. We did a lot of experimenting, not as much performing as we did sort of theater research. And in the end, that was one of the things we I think, uncovered some incredible veins of work in the 2 to 3 years that we spent working together as an ensemble in Oberlin. The fact that we didn't perform as much, finally, I think, was part of a restlessness that I felt then with that kind of work, and found myself dreaming, sort of daydreaming and ruminating often on an earthier kind of, equally surreal, but a sort of earthier and more popular kind of theater form, and became very interested in carnival and circus as a way of life and as a theater form, as an entertainment form. So it just happened very neatly that when the ensemble, we worked under the name of Kraken, the company that Herb Blau directed, when it went into a hiatus period, I was accepted at the Ringling Brothers Clown College, which made a sort of strange juncture, and yet actually, in many ways, it was a kind of seamless development because we were doing lots of physical and, as we called it in those days, psychophysical work in the ensemble. When I got to the Ringling Brothers School, they were teaching us, trying their best anyway, to teach us elementary tumbling and kind of stretching and contortionism, elephant riding, juggling, basic gag structure. I really didn't feel as out of place as one might think going right into a study of the circus form.
You said that performing in the college musical seemed vaguely unethical. How have you resolved the age-old question, how can you sing and dance on stage when people are dying in war?
I'm not sure there's any resolution. Except that as I get older, there does seem to be, oh dear, I hope I don't, at all costs, I'll try to avoid being waxing philosophical. But if your singing and dancing somehow has as much to do with people dying as well as people living, I think there is a way. I've been able, being in New York, to see some of the great singers and dancers on Broadway and off-Broadway stages, and those people who really touch you, though often the whole show, the whole Broadway show that you may go to see as a whole is unsatisfying, there can be moments because you're seeing these greatest and most honed of performers. There can be a moment when their singing and dancing is a kind of, I guess it's a kind of poem, physical poem, that seems to speak about the whole world. And is not really entertainment in the sense of diverting one from thinking about the whole world. It's putting one in touch. That's the kind of work I would love to be part of and try to be part of.
When you were in, well, I understand that you've openly acknowledged your debt to Keaton and Jeff, to quote somebody who I'd been reading.
I'd be a fool not to.
if you could talk with them now, are there things that you'd really want to ask them about their work and how they did certain scenes?
You know, that's a good, very, very good question. It's an exciting thought, although I remember reading an account of the film late in his life that Keaton did, I've forgotten who directed it, but the script was put together, Samuel Beckett. It was a thing he really conceived, possibly with Keaton in mind. And these two, Beckett had admired Keaton's work for many, many years. The two of them got together and apparently had nothing much to say to one another. And from what I've read, Keaton's incredible eloquence on film and his sort of natural affinity with speaking on film didn't translate itself into ordinary conversation. He was kind of a monosyllabic speaker who really did, really spoke else and sang elsewhere. I guess if I were to fantasize about getting to meet Keaton, and not just Keaton, but all many, many masters of that era, that silent film era, I would love to be in a place with them where one could trade ideas and talk about issues of timing and issues of camera angle and exposure. Mostly issues of timing, I think. Watching the difference between somebody who makes you laugh and somebody who really makes you laugh has to do with a certain timing and sort of view taken of the world in terms of the timing of a piece of business.
I bet you subvert all the timing that you learned in clown college. Do you?
This is a very good question. Sometimes it's a good idea to subvert it, to sophisticate it. On the other hand, I notice often that that's one of the great pitfalls of a kind of too intellectual kind of clowning. Is there are basic chemical sort of visceral rhythms. When I'm teaching classes, I always talk about the limerick. The limerick is a sort of very satisfying poem structure. Really earthy, and partly because of its rhythmic structures, da 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 da, and basic physical gags often work in the same kind of thing. So that the payoff is strongest and the laugh is most visceral when you time it out so the culmination of the gag you're doing comes right on that rhythmic beat. If you have it a moment before or after, the audience may see the joke but not appreciate it physically in the same way. There are some sort of basic physical rhythms. The old clowns talk about, sometimes it's even called the Holy Trinity. If you do something once and then you repeat it the second time, on the third time, somebody watching, an audience watching, is ready for some sort of culminating payoff. It's often called blow off or payoff or sometimes a gag point. So that oftentimes, for instance, the clown hangs his coat in midair. It falls to the ground. And you take that same coat, brush it off, and hang it in midair with the purest innocence of expectation that it's going to hang there in midair. And of course, the second time it hits the ground. I saw this on film once. I've never seen it done live. A German clown takes his coat, hangs it in midair. It stays there, but his pants fall down. And it's a moment of sort of bizarre and absurd surrealism, but a moment that's as much rhythmically realized as it is a joke about a person's pants falling down. That's the kind of sort of ageless humor that I'm drawn to in these clown traditions.
Did you watch clowns when you were young? Are there clowns that you liked or disliked?
Well, like everybody in my generation, I watched a lot of television. I sat in front of that box a sort of frightening number of hours. I think it may have been that we saw the things we saw in the 50s may have been a little more interesting than what's on television now, although I have no way of knowing. I remember watching a lot of Burns and Allen and Jack Benny and early people who had – one of the things that I think produced sort of an interesting era of television then is maybe the same thing that produced a great era of filmmaking in the 20s, is that people were coming out of a long apprenticeship doing stage work. There was vaudeville musical circuits, out of which people graduated, and they had sort of like doctors now. They had done a training and a residency and an internship before that, so that they were really ready to perform. All too often now, actors of my generation, very, very talented people who may have accomplishment coming to them eventually. Many of us, I think, get onto television or into a too visible sort of medium too soon, and that basic sort of grounding and apprenticeship is not there. So I remember watching a lot of people who now, with some historical perspective, seem like real masters. Jack Benny and Phil Silvers. It's amazing to me. Sometimes I'll sit and watch those old reruns, how many things I can remember almost verbatim from having seen them once as a kid. Phil Silvers is a great structural comedian. A lot of the jokes that he made were, you could sort of see almost visually the structural setup to some joke that he made. And I feel almost like some sort of cultural kinship when I see something that I remember from those times. I guess I do remember going to some circuses as a child, though that's a much more sort of distant and almost scary memory, because maybe scary is not the right word, but there's a whole different kind of memory of going to a circus. I remember that the thing about television is that it's really a kind of a private experience in many ways. You can sort of sit by yourself and almost ruminate as you're watching.
I have really negative associations with clowns, as opposed to comedians, with the clowns with the bulb nose, mm-hmm. and the clown suit on. And for TV, I can think of like Clarabelle on the Happy
yes.
Duty Show.
Yes.
And well, there was International Circus, and there were always clowns there.
Oh, right.
But they always seemed to me to be pathetic victims. And I never thought they were very funny. Maybe I've been exposed to the wrong clowns. But
that's a good question. Most people have sooner or later admit that I really didn't like clowns as
really?
A kid. Yeah. And I think I have had much of the same experience. But at the same time, and maybe even part of that scariness, there is a sort of a there's a kind of very immediate surrealism that I did become and have become very interested in. And I think you're right. There is a sort of, there's a whole range of clowning in small circuses, especially the clowns are the guys who drive the truck. You know, they drive the truck all night and they get paid an extra few dollars to walk around and sell coloring books in a clown costume. So there's a great difference between people who are dressed as clowns to serve a certain purpose, either in a circus or in a shopping mall or wherever, and people who really work as clowns. Though I don't want to run down the American circus, that's often done far too much. The American circus has its place in the pantheon of the circus world. But truly, the great clowns tend either to come from circus in Europe. I'm talking about the great circus clowns now. Either come from circus in Europe or at least at some point get a sense of what European clowning is. Because in the single ring European circus, that's where the clown's craft is most truly seen. In the big three-ring format in American circuses, it's much harder to see and appreciate, and the clown's importance, I think, slips a bit and is different in the big-style circus.
Could you give us an example of how, in one of your pieces, something you learned in clown college and something that you've done in your experimental theater performances have come together to produce something else?
Sure. The idea that we're exploring, I hope, in a very viscerally funny way, but with sort of, at the same time, a dark undercurrent in this piece, The Regard of Flight, is the whole idea of somebody questioning from outside. He begins in the audience, and he insinuates himself into the piece in more and more stranger and stranger ways, so that finally it becomes a knockabout physical duel of a certain sort. And we call upon at that point some of the basic slaps and falls that I studied in the Ringling School. Oftentimes I think those slaps and falls are used in a not very funny way, and many times clowns come to depend on them too much. There's a sort of witless violence that pervades certain clowns' work. But it is, at the same time, impossible to deny that there is a basic human reaction to people hitting each other and people falling. And especially in sort of more stylized clown form, I think it's speaks a lot more meaningfully to me than, say, cars crashing into one another on television. It's the difference, say, between a kind of stylized theater like Kabuki or the Peking Opera speaking about war as opposed to seeing endless cop chases and guns shooting at one another on television. So that a very immediate use we have made, is this basic vocabulary of slaps and falls. And so that for a moment in the piece, the dreamer finds himself in a kind of baggy pants knockabout routine with the critic who has begun asking sort of fairly innocuous questions. The questions become more and more challenging, and finally they're locked in a kind of clown knockabout duel on the stage.
What are some of the tricks to delivering and receiving blows without hurting one another?
It's a good question. The thing often said about falling down is that if the audience laughs hard enough and responds strongly enough, nothing hurts. You can do anything. It only hurts when they don't. There are basic sort of catching techniques that bring one to the floor. I'm not a great faller. I have sort of a bony construction, and so my falls tend to be more artful than spectacular. Though, again, the timing aids one. There's a basic, talking about three-line structure, there's a basic sort of sequence that I have used often in like performance artwork, taking the clown image and putting it in within an all-white walled studio in a sort of almost museum sense. It's a very powerful image, I find, the sort of immediacy but slightly abstracted quality that you can get, a baggy pants clown that sort of touches upon that cultural memory we have of vaudeville and burlesque comedians running in a circle in an open studio space, so that I run once and in that first circle trip once. It's just a quick trip and recover. Same spot again on the next circle trip and recover, always studying that point with some concern. The next time I come around, I jump over the point with a sort of freedom of flight, having gone over that point, not being, and as soon as, of course, you touch the ground on the other side of that jump, you trip there and fall down. So it's a slightly delayed payoff. That's a basic three-line clown structure, and it seems to make the avant-garde art world laugh as hard as it does anybody in a circus ring.
So that's, again, learning to fall without actually hurting yourself. You're studying ballet now, and I guess you have been for a while. It seems that in ballet, what you're really trying to do is to make it seem like you're exempt from the laws of gravity, that you can be so graceful while you're rising upwards in spite of the fact that there's this force pulling you down.
Yeah.
And you're always being victimized as a performer by the laws of gravity. How do you use ballet within that?
Well, I'm the most beginning of ballet students. I'm finding it valuable as a means of study, also as a sort of conditioning for the body, and as a I can't think quite of the right word I want, as a means of holding on to stamina and using the body correctly. But in fact, the questions of grace versus awkwardness that you approach when you study ballet, and how the turning of the elbow changes someone's perception as they watch you move, are exactly the questions that the craft of clowning raises also. And I often try to make that clear when I am, for instance, invited to teach in a dance setting. I was asked to teach last summer at the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in Massachusetts. And I think that some of the students were immediately interested in studying clowning. Some were not. They thought, well, my time is very valuable. I really want to audition for ABT in 2 years, and Baryshnikov is not going to be interested in how well I can fall down. He wants to see me leap. And the questions, though, of how you elude gravity or seem somehow to, through your craft, find some slight, if only momentary, release from gravity, are exactly the questions that the clown wants to look at, or student of clowning, possibly a second later, that return to Earth is maybe more the question that the clown wants to look at. Also, though, that yearning for what Baryshnikov can do but the rest of us can't is an important question in trying to make people laugh and also make people help us all see one another, help us see ourselves. That sort of innocent yearning to be able to leap has a lot to do with what's funny about trying to jump over the place that I've tripped on twice. I tripped once, I'm not going to be fooled this time. I'm going to jump right over that. And for a moment, I am in flight, and then upon touching the floor, boop, that's where the trip and the sprawl comes.
You'll be doing a lecture demonstration this evening. What will you be covering in it?
Well, I'll be, I hope, talking less and doing more about my love for and concern with the American and European clowning traditions. I'll be sort of talking about the ways that I came to be interested and the principles of clowning that I've discovered in working and studying as a clown. I'll be doing some bits of material from things I've done in the past, talking about the different styles of clowning and trying to, and I think it'll be very interestingly set within the Painted Bride Art Center's context there, trying to talk about this tension that I think makes the work interesting, this tension between being drawn to the new, the trying to find what theater should be. We're never any of us quite content with what the theater is, which is good because that means it'll continue to struggle to find out what it should be. Between that search for the new and the sort of love for what is ageless. So the lecture demonstration tonight as part of the Bread Fest during the month of June will be me, as I say, talking less and doing much more in my about my work as far as being a clown and avant-garde performance artist.
Well, this will be at 8:30 tonight at the Painted Bride Art Center, and that's at 146 North Bread Street. And again, this is Bread Street right between 2nd and 3rd. And the Painted Bride Art Center is on Bread between 2nd and 3rd, right between, it's just south of Ray Street. So it's not hard to find. And you can call the Painted Bride for more information. And there is a festival going on, which you can also find out more about by calling. Again, Bill Irwin will be there tonight at 8:30. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing you talk about theater and performance. Thanks so much for coming to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
Bill Irwin's also performing in New York. Should you be in New York, he's at the American Place Theater doing a new piece called The Regard of Flight. And will that continue through June?
Continue through June, right.
How do you like New York, by the way?
It's muggy.
That's right. Bill's usually based in San Francisco, right?
I love New York very much, actually, and we're enjoying playing for New York audiences.
Terrific. Well, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
It's 6 minutes after 3. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.